The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But first, Vladimir Putin will not attend direct peace talks with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that were scheduled to take place in Istanbul in Turkey today. And it was the Russian leader who first proposed the idea of peace talks. And in response, Volodymyr Zelensky said he would meet only with Vladimir Putin. We'll get full analysis in a moment from Donacho Bachoin. But first, aboard Air Force One yesterday, Donald Trump was asked what happens if Vladimir Putin doesn't show up in Turkey today.
Well, I don't know if he's showing up. I know he would like me to be there. And that's a possibility. If we could end the war, I'd be thinking about that. Now, tomorrow, we're all bunked out, you understand, and we're all set.
But you'd go if he goes?
I'd go UAE tomorrow. And so we have a very full situation. Now, that doesn't mean I wouldn't do it to save a lot of lives and come back. But, I'm thinking about something. I don't know that he would be there if I'm not there. We're going to find out. Parker's going. And Marco has been very effective.
So just Secretary of State Marco Rubio in Turkey today, with Trump only attending if Putin goes, because Putin would want him there. Now joining us is Donacho Bachoin, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU. Donacho, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Did anyone really expect Putin to leave his sanctuary in Moscow and head to Istanbul, exposing himself potentially?
I think most seasoned observers didn't expect him because this was never really about serious peace talks. This was never about bringing a war, the war in Ukraine to an end. This was a tactical response to what happened in Kyiv. You had the leaders of the United Kingdom, of France, of Germany, of Poland standing side by side with Volodymyr Zelensky, and also communicating with Donald Trump via video link, seemingly all on the same page, saying we want ceasefire now or there will be sanctions on Russia. And it seemed to some that Trump was pivoting, implausible as it may seem, back towards Zelensky, back towards Ukraine and away from Putin. So Putin needed to show that he was in earnest to Trump. It's all aimed at impressing Trump at the end of the day. And so he kind of upped the ante and said, well, look, forget about the ceasefire. Let's have talks and let's have them in Istanbul. They'll be unconditional. It'll be on Thursday. So Zelensky, the ball was back in his court. That was Putin, the way Putin wanted it. He wanted it to be that way. So Zelensky returned and said that I'll see you there in Istanbul and we'll have those talks. And we waited and waited, of course, to see whether Putin would up the ante again. But in this case, he folded. But as I said, that's because, and I'm using the metaphor here that Trump likes, of course, of playing cards. He was never, as I said, in earnest about a peace summit. He really saw this as a way of dragging out the war because he has no interest right now in ending the war. That's the unfortunate reality.
Yeah, Putin imagines that over the summer campaigns that he can gain even more territory. And if eventually he is forced to a ceasefire and the negotiating table, he will have more territory in his possession, which strengthens his bargaining power.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that Vladimir Putin is going to hand over territory that Russia already occupies as a result of peaceful negotiations. There's no precedent for that. And therefore, since he feels that the momentum is with him, since he feels that Ukraine's allies are either weak in the case of Europe or indifferent or indeed hostile in the case of Donald Trump, this is a good time to press home whatever advantages Russia enjoys. And Russia does enjoy always that asymmetrical numerical advantage in terms of personnel. They outnumber Ukraine 3-4-1 in terms of the military industrial complex, which is huge in Russia. Ukraine has been catching up, as a result of this imposed conflict, but it's still somewhat behind. And that's one of the reasons why, as I said, that Vladimir Putin really isn't interested in kind of moving towards a negotiated settlement right now.
So what is going to happen today? There is a delegation on behalf of Putin there, led by a man called Vladimir Medinsky, who's a presidential aide. That's how he's described. And on the other side, you've got Marco Rubio and an entourage. I mean, what will happen? Zelensky is in Ankara. He's not going to be there. He's not going to fly to Istanbul, although he is on hand. Should Putin suddenly arrive, Zelensky's nearby.
Yeah, so Zelensky made clear that he was only interested in talking to Putin because only Putin has the power, in his view, to bring an end to the war.
Also, there's parity of esteem, isn't there? That it should be president to president and not President Zelensky to some presidential aide of Putin's. That would not display any parity of esteem.
Absolutely. And indeed, the Russians are, you know, in a way, devaluing their own initiative by this low level delegation that they're sending to Turkey. I mean, you know, Donald Trump, the leader of the United States, the most powerful country in the world, said he would fly if Zelensky and Putin were there. Zelensky is already in Turkey. So it's Vladimir Putin then that sends this low level delegation of, you know, largely loyal technocrats. And it's made very clear that he's not looking for, you know, a negotiation on substantial issues. It's really about minor issues, which, as I said, I think the tactic is that this would drag on for months and would be in parallel to Russia's prosecution of the war.
So what is the outcome of all of this? There'll be, as you say, negotiating on the fringes, maybe even negotiating about a future negotiation. But, I mean, is Marco Rubio equipped to even have a go at this low-level delegation?
I don't think so, because Marco Rubio, and in this sense, he is very like Putin's emissaries, I don't think has the power of initiative. He's not a real plenipotentiary with the power to make decisions on his own initiative. He always has to refer it back to his capital, to his leader. So I think that they will see more or less the Russians reiterate their demands. I mean, Putin's position all along has been that the root causes of the conflict from his perspective have to be addressed. And from his perspective, that is the demilitarization and the subordination of Ukraine. And they will reiterate that. They will have a whole range of technical ways that can be demonstrated by the size of the Ukrainian army and, you know, the fact that they can never join NATO and for, you know, a whole range of things. And there won't be any security guarantees for Ukraine. They will reiterate all of that. I mean, in a way, the location is inauspicious because there were talks in March 2022 in Istanbul, and actually some of the personnel on the Russian side now were there in March 2022. And those talks went nowhere because it became clear that the Russians were looking for capitulation. And this was at a time, actually, when the Ukrainians were pushing back already Russians from Kyiv and would soon after around Kharkiv. And then, of course, there was the discoveries of the massacres in Bucha and Irpin, and that completely transformed the atmosphere of the Ukrainian negotiating team. And I think it's also fair to say the Ukrainians thought they would get more help at the time. They weren't getting any help, really, from the West, but there were hints that they might get more. And those talks ended. So we're back where we were 3.5 years later at the same place with the same negotiating team, it seems, largely on behalf of Russia. But their demands haven't changed. And that's why I think it's hard to be optimistic about the outcome of these low level negotiations right now.
Now, obviously, Putin is a wanted war criminal, potentially accused of such charges. Presumably, no one would dare arrest him as the leader of Russia, were he to visit a country that is signatory to the international criminal court.
Well, that's true. It would be the case that, I mean, Ireland and other countries, there's more than 100 of them who are signatories of the Rome Statute, are bound to arrest Vladimir Putin. But that has been tested in recent times. Vladimir Putin went to Mongolia shortly after that arrest warrant was issued. And Mongolia is a signatory, but Mongolia is very dependent on Russia and China and a squeeze between the two. And Putin more or less invited himself to test the Mongolians. And then he demonstrated to the world that, look, here's a country that is signed up to the Rome Statute and they haven't arrested me. And of course, recently we saw Viktor Orban invite Benjamin Netanyahu to visit Hungary. And Hungary is also a signatory to the Rome Statute and therefore should have arrested Benjamin Netanyahu, but they invited him. So unfortunately, one of the many results of these conflicts, particularly Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is we're seeing an erosion of respect for international law. And that's going to have longer term implications that will certainly outlast this conflict. Mm-hmm.
Now, Putin, when we look at the personalities of the various players in all of this, I mean, we all cast Zelensky as a rather heroic figure, given the odds that he is up against. Trump, on the other hand, we know he's a narcissist, and we also know that he wants a win. He wants to bring about peace in Ukraine, peace in the Middle East, and so on, because he has ambitions, incredibly, to get a Nobel Peace Prize, because Obama has one. That's the cynical view. And John Bolton, his former ambassador to the United Nations, takes that view. Putin, on the other hand, is a man who attempted a special military operation that was supposed to be over in days and has now dragged on into years, although he can propagandize his people into believing something else entirely. But this has been a failed venture for Putin so far.
It has been a failed venture, and it's still a very high-risk venture because democracies can lose war. And indeed, there's many examples of the United States losing wars in relatively recent history. It's a much more difficult thing for a dictatorship to lose a war. You look at how the Argentinians invaded the Falklands. When they lost that war, the Argentinian dictatorship fell. Dictatorships don't usually survive because their power rests on the perception that they're invulnerable, that they have a monopoly of coercive power. And that's the dictator's dilemma. You can never hand over power peacefully because you can never trust anyone. So most dictators, they leave power, horizontally. They never go voluntarily. And life cycles rather than electoral cycles dictate how long that they are in power. So, and we saw this with the rebellion. Remember Prigozhin's rebellion in June 2023, how, there wasn't a mass mobilization of Russian civil society to defend Putin. Putin knows that it's his perception of power and the kind of the violence and the repressive violence that he has at his disposal. That's what keeps him in power. So losing a war, which, was always a possibility when he invaded Ukraine, has always been there in the background. And that's why, again, he doesn't want to lose face in any way, to give a sign to anybody in Russia that he's there for the taking and that his position is weak.
Now, we have always been discussing over the last couple of years whether or not that Trump is a Russian asset, whether, a useful idiot, or whether or not he actually was recruited way back in the 80s by the Russians to be a kind of a sleeper that they could utilize effectively. So we don't really know. If that is the case, well, then he will always kind of bend to Putin's will. If, on the other hand, he is something of his own man and he wants this peace, there is the possibility that he could rearm Ukraine in order to put pressure on Russia to get to that ceasefire.
Yeah, and Putin, knows that he's an unpredictable character, and that's one of the reasons why he came up with this kind of ad hoc suggestion of talks, direct talks between Ukrainians and Russians for the first time in more than 3 years in Istanbul. It was largely because he felt that he was losing Trump's goodwill, so to speak. So, and Trump presents this as a strategy that, he's unpredictable and this is all part of the art of the deal, as it were. But it's largely as well because he wants quick wins. He's not a man of detail. And, the fact that he was only willing to go to Istanbul if there was no hard work to be done, but more or less the big actors, Putin and Zelensky, were already there and were coming to what looked like an agreement. So he wants to be there, to cut the ribbon, but he's not going to be there to do the elbow grease. And you look at how the situation in the Middle East is panning out. I mean, there was also a peace process there, and he's wedded himself, of course, to Benjamin Netanyahu, but there's been no progress. So he didn't mention that during his Middle East tours, because he doesn't like to be associated with things that are not going well. He is still a key player, largely because the United States is still the biggest economy, and Ukraine and indeed Europe still depend on the United States for much of its security. So until that situation declines, and I think there will be a reevaluation, there is already a reevaluation in Europe about the American security guarantee. I mean, Trump will be a player, irrespective of his personal quirks.
And we talk about his personal quirks, and we will be talking more about Trump and the Middle East later on in the program. But the question is the quality of advice that he has. I mean, Marco Rubio sacks a whole pile of people in the State Department. Officials all over the place are being fired. Biden people being replaced, or even Obama people being replaced by the Trump regime, because it's not Trump making all these decisions. It's people like Stephen Miller and those kind of acolytes. The question is the quality of advice that this one-page man gets.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, I think, really symbolized by the choice of Witkoff to be his conflict manager. I mean, he's not only responsible for the Middle East peace negotiations such as they are, but also de facto he's in charge of the Russia-Ukraine situation. And you see him, arriving, fawning over Putin and arriving unaided. I mean, the Russians provided him with his own with their interpreter for the conference. There was Putin was armed with a number of advisors and key personnel, and Witkoff arrives in Moscow by himself. I mean, it's very amateur. You feel that, Trump keeps talking about playing cards and looking for this quick win, whereas you feel that the Russians are playing chess and are far more strategic. And that's why I think that they've managed to outplay Trump in many respects when it comes to, trying to temper the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Donako Bakhoin, Professor of Politics at the School of Law and Government at DCU. Thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.